All right, we'll go ahead and dive right in to Romans 4. Last week we ended at verse 8, so we'll pick up at verse 9 if you want to go ahead and turn there if you haven't already. We are in our second lesson under the heading, The History of the Gospel. And last week we looked at Paul taking justification by faith alone, some of the foundational doctrines that Steve walked us through from the end of chapter 3, the last 11 verses. And Paul is going to now put legs on those verses. And what does justification by faith alone look like? How does it relate to the Old Testament? We learned, you know, about propitiation and just in the justifier and those foundational doctrines. And Paul's point in the first part of chapter 4 is to say these are not new doctrines. We have always believed these things. God has always been teaching these things in different ways, using different signs and different means. And we'll get into those signs and means here in a little bit. Paul is going to prove to us, as he did hopefully last week and going to continue on, especially if you look at verse 5. This was one of the main verses of last week. But to the one who does not work but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited as righteousness. So we learn it's not the one who works that gets righteousness. It's actually the one who stops working. So you're not saved. It's before justification. And you need to stop working. Quit trying to earn favor with God by your good works or your law keeping or any of those things. And it's a simple taking your trust, an intellectual mindset of knowing God. And then that's going to birth then a confidence and a trust into this God that He does, and He will do what He says He's going to do. And His promises to do in the future are as good as already done. And that being said, this perfection that it takes, that we learned about this morning, this perfection that it takes to enter heaven has been lived out through Christ. And that sacrificial death that we deserve was someone stood in our place. And so last week we learned another huge point of chapter 4 was imputation. And we get that from the word credited, and you'll see it even in this verse right here in verse 5, and you'll see it 10 more times in this chapter. So our sin account was wiped clean, past, present, and future, because Christ took all of those sins on him. But as you remember, it doesn't just stop with your slate being wiped clean. You have a righteousness now imputed onto you, and that you're your guilty status as a sinner has then been changed to a righteous status. So when God looks at you, He doesn't see your sin and your filth. He now sees the Jesus Christ and all His righteousness. And that's the great exchange of the gospel. That's justification. The sinner gets pardoned by God the moment the sinner puts his or her trust in Christ. So with Paul setting forth that illustration by using Abraham and David, he understands that there's Jews now in Rome that are hearing this, and they understand the basic major teachings of the faith, of the Jewish faith. And for example, Abraham, they would say, was justified by his merit of faith. Abraham did plenty of works to be justified, and faith was one of just many of the works. And so with the Jewish person thinking that justification is by works, this is Paul coming at Romans 4 with the Jew thinking that justification is by works of the law, and Gentiles more than likely being confused on the whole deal, Paul perceives the importance now of doubling down on Abraham and going further with this teaching, using Abraham again to prove his point, which today's main point is salvation is by grace alone. Last week, and we'll touch on this still today, but salvation was by faith, was through faith, and this week is salvation by grace and not law. So if Paul, by the power of the Holy Spirit, can show arguably the greatest Old Testament person in the Jews' eyes, especially Abraham, the father of our faith, if he can show that he was justified by faith alone, by grace alone, through faith alone, and apart from works, and if that's true, then anybody can be saved, and you don't have to do these laws, and you don't have to be circumcised, and all these different things that the Jews were laying down at everybody and saying, you're going to have to be like us to be saved. And Paul's saying, that's not the case. And he's going to choose Abraham to prove that. And if he can do that, then anybody can be saved. And he's going to also, at disproving the Jews, that their foundation for the last 2,000 to 4,000 years has been wrong. That God saves sinners by grace, and if Abraham is saved like that, then so can you. So if you want to turn to verse 9, this is Paul. Is this blessing then on the circumcised or on the uncircumcised? So the blessing that we just saw last week in verses 7 and 8, is this blessing then on the circumcised or the uncircumcised also? For we say faith was credited to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it credited? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? Not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, so that he might be the father of all those who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them. And the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised. For the promise to Abraham or to his descendants that he would be heir of the world was not through law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void and the promise is nullified. For the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, there is no violation. For this reason it is by faith, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, a father of many nations have I made you, in the presence of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. So Paul, starting out in verse 9 there, is this blessing that verse 7 and 8 talk about, is it on the circumcised or uncircumcised? Another way of saying this, is this blessing only limited to Israel, or is it open and extend to everyone? For we say, as Paul quotes again, Genesis 15:6, that's kind of a main text throughout Romans 4, faith was credited to Abraham as righteousness. So we must ask, as verse 10 does, well, how was it credited? While Abraham was circumcised or uncircumcised? So it's a simple question, but yet it's profound in its answer. Paul tells us, just in case we don't know or we can't count, he says, not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. This blessing of imputation, this blessing of justification by faith alone was before Abraham was circumcised. And that's like a nail in the coffin to the Jew, because they're holding great weight. The Jews hold great weight in circumcision and the law. And Abraham was justified before circumcision. And remember, this springs from Romans 3, 29 through 30. Or is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of the Gentiles also? Yes, of the Gentiles also. Since indeed God will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith. He is one. So, premise one, Abraham was righteous before God. That's a true statement. Premise two, before he was circumcised. He was righteous before he was circumcised. Conclusion, circumcision is unnecessary in order to be counted righteous. That's the point that we need to get from those verse 9 and 10, that Abraham was considered righteous before circumcision even came along. And we know that because chronology teaches us that Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised. Genesis 17:24. Now, Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised. And on that same day, Ishmael, his illegitimate son, was circumcised as well, and he was 13 years of age. And you remember that when God counted Abraham righteous in Genesis 15:6, now he's being circumcised in Genesis 17:24. Genesis 15 comes before Genesis 17, so it's a simple math there. You can understand that he was counted righteous before circumcision, which is a big deal. It's a big deal to those in Rome, and especially to the Jews there. So let's get this straight. Abraham was an uncircumcised Gentile who was counted righteous. And then to make the point even clearer, Ishmael, the son of Hagar, which is Abraham's wife, Sarah's servant, was circumcised, and he was not considered in the covenant. He was outside the covenant, even though he was circumcised. So that tells us Paul clearly thought it was compelling enough to tell us that no rite, no religious ceremony can produce any righteousness in anyone whatsoever. It didn't on Abraham, it didn't on Ishmael, and it doesn't on any of us. Now that's the main gist of that, is to realize that no work of the law, no circumcision, baptism, Lord's Supper, any of that is going to play any role in your justification. So now we must ask, as verse 10 asks, how then, what is it credited, while circumcised or uncircumcised? And we know the right answer now. It was while he was uncircumcised. But what difference does that make? And it makes a big, big difference. This means that God justifies us before and apart of our obedience to any type of ordinance. That he doesn't wait and look and see if we have an obedience to one of his ordinances to then therefore justify us. And this is relevant to us today in regards to baptism. You'll hear a lot of people say, especially in this community, through the Church of Christ, that you must be baptized to be saved. You must be baptized to be saved. Catholicism teaches you got to have your original sin washed away before God will accept you. So you got to be baptized before you are saved. You got to be baptized before you're justified. Some Lutheran, some Anglican hold to this. So this is right in Bowling Green, Kentucky today, that there is a work you must do before God will either hear your prayer or see that he needs to justify you. And the good news is that we are declared righteous apart from any works of the law, circumcision, baptism, any of that. And not saying that any of those are wrong in and of themselves, but if they are remotely one of the rungs on your ladder to which you try to climb to God, then you are not justified if that's the way you see justification. You would have here at this point in Rome, you would have Jewish Christians hearing this. You would have Gentile Christians hearing this. The Jewish Christians would hear it, and if they had any pride whatsoever in their circumcision, by God's grace, it was crushed when Paul said this. And any Gentiles that might have been confused on, are they truly believers even though they hadn't been circumcised? May they, by God's grace, gain confidence after they heard Paul's letter read to them at this point. So if you're a thinking person, you're thinking, okay, if that doesn't justify you, what is the point of circumcision? What is the point of all this? And if it can't even save or have any part of that? And that takes us right to Romans 4:11. You see there, and he received the sign of circumcision, Abraham, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, so that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them. It's a little choppy. It was the purpose to be the father of all those who believe in order that the righteousness might be credited to them, is kind of how the ESV words it, and a little easier to read. So let's unpack this. He did receive the sign of circumcision. He did end up receiving it when he was 99. And that was a sign pointing to what had already happened in his heart. And what is the sign of circumcision? What is the sign of circumcision? But before we can understand that, we have to understand what is circumcision. First, it was a mark. It was a mark to mark all God's physically all God's physical people. Identification marker of a certain race. A person could be identified as a child of Abraham because he had circumcision. Another name would be Jew. He was considered a Jew if he was circumcised. The second thing it marked was to show that that person was going under the heading of Abraham inside the covenant. It was to show that they were set apart. God was setting apart a people from all the other nations that were serving idols of all sorts. He was going to set apart a group of people, a certain race, and he marked them by the mark of circumcision. And thirdly, it was a spiritual sign and seal. And so every time people saw circumcision occur, so you're 25 years old and you see a baby that was born 8 days later, he gets circumcised. Every time you would see that, you would be reminded of your Jewishness, of your father Abraham, and God's covenant with Abraham. And it was a sign of pointing to authenticate that faith. And so back to the sign. What does Paul mean by sign of circumcision? Dr. John MacArthur uses an illustration that stood out with me in my preparation. And he says, circumcision is not a reality, it is a sign. And that's what Paul says, circumcision is a sign. And MacArthur says, there is a difference between a sign and a substance. If you drive to Los Angeles and you see a sign that says Los Angeles and an arrow, and then you go up and crawl on that sign and hang on to that sign and say, we're here, then the sign reflects another reality. You don't ever climb up on that sign and say we're here, because the sign's not Los Angeles. The sign is pointing to Los Angeles or saying that you're getting close, you're a mile away or whatever. And so the sign reflects another reality. It points you to something. It symbolizes something. It directs you to something. It is not to be confused with that something to which it points. And then he ends with, a sign is a symbol of something else. It points to something else. And so, just like that sign that says Los Angeles, the sign of circumcision is to authenticate Abraham's faith that God already created in him. Circumcision did not save, but it signified that God would save, that God would circumcise the heart, and that he would grant righteousness as he did to Abraham, just like the Lord's table doesn't save, but it points to that God will save. Look at what God has done for you. Baptism does not save, but it declares God will save, and then if you are baptized, it's declaring to everyone what God has done already to you. It's a sign pointing, and it's always pointing to God. It's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end, and that end, of course, is God. There's a lot of heresy that can attract itself. It's a weird reason. I guess it's because the lack of the gospel truth, so you have to find some type of sign or some type of symbol to put all your marbles in and say, that's what has gotten me justified. That's what saved me, is baptism or circumcision or the law. And because it's a lack of gospel knowledge and trust in Christ, so you hold on to the sign. So there's a lot of heresy that can be attractive in this. And God has set signs to point to his promises, not so you can earn favor with him by keeping those promises. Verse 11 says that Abraham is the father of faith to even those that were not circumcised. So why is that important? Well, Paul tells us so that he might be the father of all those who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness would then be credited to them. What does he mean by that? Well, Abraham is the father of all believers. Abraham is the father of Jews and Gentiles. He came by faith to God, so we too can all come by faith to God. So whether you're a Jewish believer or a Gentile believer, your father is Abraham, because he is his spiritual offspring that was promised, and we'll get to in just a minute. And so to summarize verse 11, Abraham took the sign of circumcision. He took that sign, which was a seal of the righteousness of faith, which he had while he was uncircumcised. But he took it as a sign, so he would show that he is the father of all who believe without being circumcised. And that was to show everyone that they could get righteousness then imputed to them. And verse 12 tells us that too. And the father of circumcision to those who are not only are of the circumcision, the Jews, but also to follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised, Gentiles. So simply, Abraham is the father of Gentiles that are not circumcised but still believe, and he is the father of the Jews who are circumcised and still believe. He is the patriarch of our faith. And so to understand 9 through 11, Abraham believed and was justified before he was circumcised. But what about the law? So Paul used circumcision there clearly to state, is circumcision what justifies you? No, because Abraham was justified and he wasn't circumcised when he was justified. So now what about the law, the keeping of the law? Verse 13 touches on that. For the promise to Abraham, or to his descendants, that he would be heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. So Jews held circumcision really high. The second thing, when a part of that, is the law. Jews held that keeping of the law was essential to be justified. They believed, as we've already said, that Abraham was justified by keeping of that law. And so now, verses 13 through 17, Paul is going to now take us through and deconstruct that argument of the law is what now justifies you. The reason he brings this up is just like circumcision. Chronology, it's driving this. Abraham was not made right with God by the law, by the keeping of the law, because the law wasn't even around when Abraham was here. It was 430 years later the law came after Abraham. So how could Abraham be righteous by the law? It wasn't even around. In Galatians 3, Paul tells us that, which almost is a parallel to Romans 4, Paul says, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say and to seeds as referring to many, but rather to one. And to your seed, that is Christ. What I'm saying is this. The law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. But what is this promise that he's speaking up there and of our Romans 4:13? It's the promise that Abraham would be heir of the world. So does the law, how does the law relate to that promise? Well, he was promised that 430 years before the law came around. And we see that in Genesis 12, 1 through 3. This is God. This is right when Abraham's narrative starts in Genesis. Verse 1, now the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. So verse 1 is it's like a promised land. Verse 2, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. So promised descendants. Verse 3, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. So it's a promised blessing, promised land, promised descendants, a promised redemption even. And then last week we saw in Genesis 15 that God promising Abraham that to look up to the heavens and to count the stars if he could, and that would be how many his descendants would be. And then also with the grains of sand on the earth, your descendants are going to outnumber them, Abraham. And then you see in Genesis 17, verses 1 through 7, more of God's promises to Abraham. Verse 1, now when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. Well, Abram then fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you will be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make your nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. So Abram, he was thinking to himself, I'm 99 years old. You're telling me that my name means exalted father. I have one child at this time. Now you're changing my name to father of the multitudes. Abraham means father of the multitudes. And I'm not really seeing this promise. And so 30 to 40 years are going by, and Abraham's hearing these promises from God, and that he's going to make him a great nation. He's going to have many descendants. And year after year, he continues to get older. And his wife Sarah is 90 years old, and she's been barren this entire time. So it's looking like they're going to run out of time, firstly. And then second is the promise that God keeps promising these things. It just doesn't look like it's all going to pan out, that there's time is running short. So back to verse 13. So Paul is saying that those promises were not through the law. Why? Because the law wasn't around. This is early part of Genesis, but through the righteousness of faith. So he had faith in God, that God was going to do what he said he was going to do. Through the promise that he would be the father of multitudes was by faith and not by law. So in other words, how was he made right with God before the law? God gave him a promise and he believed it. Simple as that. Or we could say, how is anybody made right? Even though we have the law now, how is anybody made right with the law? It's apart from the law, and it's through faith, the same way Abraham was. So what if you were made heir by keeping the law? What if that was an option? Then your faith would then be made void, because now your faith is nothing. You are now placing your work and your effort in something to try to get God. And in the promise that God made to Abraham would be nullified. And that's exactly what verse 14 says. For if those who are of the law are heirs, if those who are of the law are heirs, then faith is made void and the promise is nullified. And again, in Galatians 3:18, Paul says the same thing. For if the inheritance is based on the law, if that's what your inheritance is based on, It is no longer based on the promise. It's either or. But God has granted it to Abraham as means of a promise. Why? Because the law wasn't around when he promised him that. So this inheritance of land, of descendants, of redemption, does not come through the law, but through faith. And the legalist in your life, maybe the legalist in you, the legalist you know, would not really want that verse to say that, especially verse 14. They want it to say that you are made righteous and you're part of the promise through promise and law. They want both and. They want a part in it in some way. But you can't mix them at the point of justification. The law does not play a role in you being justified other than showing you need to be justified because you always fail keeping the law. But we can't mix law and promise at justification because one or the other, they nullify each other. They can't go hand in hand. And there are even sects of Christianity that we would argue are still Christians, but they come dangerously close to believing that they're playing a part in their salvation is at the forefront, that they play a part in this promise. That theology that I'm talking about is the majority when it comes to Christian theology. And they would say, if you're going to be saved, it's up to you to be saved and you alone. When it comes to Christian theology, you have to then accept Christ, and you have to, once you do accept him, you have the power first to accept him. And then secondly, once you do, you have the power to either not accept him anymore and just do away with him or continue with him. You have that power within you. You made the choice. You can keep the choice going because it's all about you. But when we'll come to in verse 16 in a minute, that means that there's no guarantee of the promise if it's residing in you, because the guarantee is resting on you to finish it. And if you know you, then you don't want that promise or that guarantee to be on you. And it's no longer a guarantee anyways, because you're not guaranteed. You can't even keep promises to your children 5 minutes later. How are you going to keep a promise to God for a whole 60 years of your life? The only way the promise of salvation can be a guarantee is the promise has to be from God and kept in God and rest in God. And Aaron told me last week, that's why we have the picture of Genesis 15, we didn't get there last week, but you got animals being split in two, and that's to ratify, showing the ratification of God's covenant. So not only did God appear to Abram, but he promised to then walk through those animals and while Abram was asleep. So by God walking through for both himself, God, and for Abraham, he was saying, if I don't do what I promise, may this happen to me, God saying that. And if Abram, if you don't do what you promised to do, and I'm walking through for you, then you can do this to me. And if you're tracking, that's why Christ came, because we didn't do our part we were supposed to do. Abram was supposed to do a part, and he couldn't do it and didn't do it. God walked through for him. Abraham failed. Therefore, God has to be crucified, because he promised that he would do, that Abraham would do what he was supposed to do. Abraham didn't. And so God himself came, had to come down as a man to be crucified, because we did not keep our side of the covenant. That's the only way the promise of salvation can be guaranteed from beginning to end, is because the promise rests in God and not in man. And we'll see that in just a minute when we get to verse 16 more. So Paul, continuing his thought about the law, comes to verse 15 in conclusion of that and says, "For the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, there is no violation." Most other translations, for some reason, and maybe even better, I don't know, they use the word transgressions there instead of violations. So what does Paul mean by verse 15? "For the law brings about wrath." Well, that's one reason why the law can't save. That's not the purpose of it. It is to bring about God's wrath. But where there is no law, there is no transgression. Paul's not saying if you're a person who doesn't know the Ten Commandments and you break those Ten Commandments, therefore you're not sinning. That's not the case. You're still sinning. But transgression means that there's a deliberate knowing of that law and then breaking that law that you know so clearly. So you come to a door, and above the door it says employees only or hard hats only. and you look at it and you're like, nah, and you go right through that door anyway. That's transgression. Deliberately, explicitly breaking the law, you can clearly see that somebody authority over you has placed, and you're breaking that. You're saying you don't. That doesn't abide on you. You can get around that. And knowing the law doesn't make us heirs. That's an important part. It only makes us double guilty when we do break the law. So now you are a transgressor. But that sign that says hard hats only or employees only, if that sign wasn't there and you still walk through, that doesn't mean that you didn't sin. You still sinned. You just wouldn't be a transgressor then. So when God laid down the law, it produced transgressions. When the transgressions then produced God's wrath, the law was a mirror to our hearts to then run us to Christ. So when it's laid down, our hearts look at it and say, there's no law going to keep me down. I'm going to break them all. It doesn't matter. And the law reveals the evil inside our hearts. It's a mirror. It shows us what's already in there. And then when you place a law in front of somebody, you'll start seeing that law broken down. It manifests, you could say, the sinfulness of man. That's its job. That's its job. So the law not only condemns the sinner, but the law actually incites the sin. And Paul tells us from his own experience in Romans 7, verse 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. So you're thinking, what's the purpose of the law? If it's not going to get me justified, what's the big deal with it anyways? It's only inciting sin. It's only manifesting sin in my life. So the law, therefore, must be sinful in itself. It must be wrong, not me. And Paul says, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through that law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, taking an opportunity through that commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. For apart from the law, sin is dead. So you make a rule, and that rule will then activate that sin that's already there in your heart. It will actually activate it, and then you'll transgress. And Steve, I think, touched on it this morning. You tell a child not to touch a mousetrap. What are they going to do? You tell a child not to pull the tail of a dog. What are they going to do? You tell a child not to climb on the blinds. What are they? That very command almost then incites it to even to happen at that point. So you see them going one way, you try to discipline. That was Steve's point. This is saying that you tell them not to touch something, don't touch the electrical outlet. They're going to run straight for it. Not 100% of the time, but you get my point. So was the law bad? No, the law's not bad. The law's good. It shows you your sin. You, in your heart, try to suppress your sin. The law's right here saying you're not suppressing nothing. Look, it's reflecting back at you. Your heart is exposed. It's opened up. You've transgressed this law. You know it. You can see it. And you actually enjoy sinning against it. Verse 16. This is the main thrust of Paul's argument. We got 10 minutes here. Verse 16, Paul says, for this reason, it is by faith, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. So this is how Abraham is saved, and this is how you are saved. And it's by grace, in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants. Center point of his argument today especially is by grace. If you're not saved by circumcision, and you're not, if you're not saved by the law, and you're not, then what are you then saved by? If those two things are not doing it, what are you then saved by? And you are saved by grace, that it may be in accordance with grace through faith. And that means God not only wanted to save you, since he set it up like that, but he wants you to know at the point of your salvation, you can rest assured, knowing that if it's by grace, it started with him, in the middle it's him, and at the end it's him. So it produces in us a joy and a resting upon him because it's founded in him. And it's guaranteed. That's a big word not to miss there. It's guaranteed to all his descendants that you would, that anybody that would come by faith, by grace through faith, would be saved. So the law is of doubt. Grace is of confidence. It's of certainty, security. And then that then produces joy. That's grace. And that's why Paul says in verse 16 that the promise is guaranteed. And so back to that theology that thinks that it's all about you and your salvation, that they would say God does have to do some of the drawing, but you have to make the ultimate choice because it ultimately resides on you and your choice. And you would say salvation is of the Lord. Salvation is by grace. And if you believe those two statements, then salvation has to be guaranteed to the true believer because that salvation is of God. So when you read a book or listen to Christian radio or listen to a sermon on the internet or visit a church when you're on vacation or whatever, and if the Christianity, you must be listening for certain things. If the Christianity that they are proclaiming is not about the promise, is not about redemption, is not about grace, if it's not about faith in its essence, then it has to be about human effort or work or merit in some way, because it's either or. It's either the human merit or God's grace. And so the conditions would be based on human effort if grace is not the center point of whatever you're listening to or exposed to in some way. So the only way it would be in accordance with grace is that it would be by faith, and that faith would be in a promise. And that's Christianity. If salvation is by grace through faith, and the promise, like I've already said, is available to everyone, and that's how God can then save the nations. Because if it's by law or circumcision, then there's going to be limited people that have access to those things. But if it's by grace, and by faith through grace, by grace through faith, then it's available to anybody who would believe. And that's how Abraham is considered the father of the multitudes. That's how it can even be accomplished, is because it's open to anyone who would believe. But what is grace? What is grace? What does it mean? Why is it so amazing? So people normally define grace as unmerited favor. And that's a great definition. But there's something that gets a little bit closer, that I think gets a little bit closer, and this is nothing that I came up with. Of course, there's nothing original, really. If you hear something original, it's probably not good. Dr. Michael Kruger, who's a president at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina, defines grace as not unmerited favor, but he defines it as demerited favor. So what does he mean by that? So unmerited favor is favor from God you didn't deserve. That's unmerited favor. Favor from God you didn't deserve. Demerited favor means giving something to somebody that doesn't deserve it, just like unmerited favor. But it goes further. It doesn't stop. They actually deserve the opposite of that favor. So not only favor from God you didn't deserve, but favor from God when you deserved the opposite. They actually deserve judgment, but they get favor. That's demerited favor. So it's not that we don't deserve grace. We actually deserve the opposite of grace. And he gives an example, Dr. Kruger does, and I think it's pretty powerful. He says, think about this illustration of adoption. Imagine you're wanting to adopt someone into your family. They haven't earned a spot into your family, but by your favor, you're going to give them something that they don't deserve, namely adoption. That's unmerited favor. But that doesn't fully capture what grace is. He says, here's an example of demerited favor. Imagine you went down to death row, to the prison, and you found someone there who committed horrible crimes, awful things. They actually deserve not to be adopted into your loving family, but they deserve prison. And by what they did, they deserve the death penalty. What if you took that person off death row and brought them into your own house, and you loved them as one of your own children? But even more than that, what if when you did that, you took one of your own children and put them on death row, take your very son and take him down to death row and take this prisoner and bring him to your home. And on top of that, you let him sleep in your son's bed and sit at the table with your family and let him sit in your son's place, and you loved him as your own child. Then you told him that he was loved and safe, and that all that was yours is now his. And now your son is on death row, punished for a crime that he didn't even commit. And then Dr. Kruger ends with this. He says, that's grace. That is what is meant by demerited favor. It's not that we get something we don't deserve. We get something when we deserve the opposite, just like that prisoner. We're the prisoner. We're the one that deserved death row, and we've been given demerited favor. We've been given that type of grace. And when you realize that, you can only think that, wow, God really does love us. Could you imagine doing that very thing? He who did not spare his own son, but he gave him up for us all, how shall he not with him freely give us all things? And I think that's a good place to end, and we're about out of time anyway. So we'll pick up next week at verse 17, and we might make it to verse 25. I hope y'all have a good week.